We are here with Ricky O'Donnell, college basketball editor for SB Nation, part-time NBA editor for SB Nation, Bulls fan, Bulls blogger extraordinaire. We're going to talk about the Bulls, obviously, today. Ricky, what's up, man?
What's going on?
Not too much. I appreciate you coming on. Usually, Seth and I will talk about the Thursday night TNT games, but I wasn't that interested in the games this week, so I decided instead we're just going to talk about the team that I think is most interesting that we haven't talked much about this year, which is the Bulls. So that's, you know, obviously why you're here. And I want to start with a post that you wrote for Bloggable about 3 weeks ago or so now, which, you know, the title I think sort of says it all, but I'll let you explain where you were coming from with it anyway. The title was, "The Chicago Bulls are a complete organizational failure from the top down." It was very interesting topic for me, because coming from someone who's a Knicks fan and actually knows what a complete organizational failure from the top down looks like, it's interesting to think that a team that has been consistently good over the last 5-6 years can also be considered that by their fan base.
Yeah, I think that, that was definitely written at a time when I feel like a lot of Bulls fans were feeling pretty disenfranchised with the state of where things were at. Like, really, to sort of defend that opinion, and I do think it might have been a bit harsh at the time, because like you said, the Bulls have been pretty successful. There's a lot of franchises that would certainly trade places with the Bulls over, you know, the last 7 or 8 years or so. But it just seems like, really since LeBron went to Miami, there's just been this golden opportunity for a second team in the Eastern Conference to rise up and really challenge him on a consistent basis. And the Bulls just appeared to be primed to do that, with D. Rose becoming the youngest MVP ever, with them hitting the jackpot on Jimmy Butler, him turning into an all-star at age 25 as the last pick in the draft. It just seemed like the Bulls were in position to really, make a run in the Eastern Conference, and they've sort of mismanaged the roster around the fringes. And, you know, I think in the NBA we all get so consumed with the fact that it's a stars league and stuff, but the last few years in the NBA Finals, I think, have really shown the importance of depth. Like, if you go back to that Spurs-Heat's NBA Finals last year with LeBron in Miami, you know, I think that the depth of San Antonio's roster in that series really shined out. You can say the same thing about Golden State. Obviously, they have tremendous star power too, but really what makes that team go, in addition to Steph and Draymond and Klay being so great, is the fact that all their role players are really good too. And it just felt like the Bulls pretty much mismanaged their role players, year after year when they were in this position where they could have potentially succeeded. Tom Thibodeau was very upset when they let go of Kyle Korver. They traded him for a trade exception that they never used, because they didn't want to pay him $5 million. Korver, of course, goes on to become an all-star 2 years later. They let Omer Asik go. Maybe that looks good in hindsight, but at the time, you know, the Bulls certainly needed that defensive presence in the second unit. That second unit with him and Taj Gibson back in 2011 and 2012 was, I believe, the best individual defensive lineup in the NBA.
I remember writing about that particular lineup at the time and being like, these guys are allowing like 87 points per 100 possessions.
Yeah, they were absolutely ridiculous. And then, of course, there's just sort of the eternal search for help on the wing. I do think that post was written a little emotionally. Perhaps I was too harsh on them. But, yeah, it just seems like the Bulls had this golden opportunity to really compete in the Eastern Conference. And now you can see the window closing and you wonder, like, how are they ever going to get back, you know, to potentially competing for titles again?
Yeah, the thing that was interesting for me was a lot of it was framed around, you know, the opportunity to deal Pau Gasol at the deadline. Obviously, he is, 36, 37? So he's not going to, or he's 35 now, turn 36 this summer. I would imagine that by the time this Bulls team is in its next version of a true contender, even if Powell's still on the team, he's not going to be nearly good enough to be sort of a foundational player. And I feel like that was sort of a very good reason alone to deal him, when you added in the fact that at the time it looked like Jimmy Butler was going to be out for like four to six weeks, and they were, you know, tumbling down the standings, and he doesn't particularly fit with the way they say, or I guess the way Fred Hoiberg professes that he wants the team to play. You know, Powell is very much, you know, a jog the ball up the court, get down into the post or near the elbow, get it to him, let him go to work. Where and you know, he is a good passer, which theoretically fits with what Hoiberg wants to do, but he's not an especially quick mover or decision maker. So that did seem like a missed opportunity. And in that sense, I agreed, like, this is something they should have done. But, I mean, I guess, you know, you did state it was, like, a little bit of an emotional overreacting type thing. So to me, it was like, why does this mean they're a complete organizational failure? When you're that, like, you're the Knicks or you're the Kings or you're the Nets, you're not a team that's good consistently.
For sure, yeah. I just think it was about more the opportunity. And now you look at the Bulls, they're not even in the Eastern Conference playoffs.
Right. They started today. Last night, they dropped out. They're half game back of the Pistons.
Yeah, and if they played the Pistons, theoretically, in a series, I think they would get smoked by Detroit just because their lineup has a lot of holes that you can take advantage of in a seven-game series. And that's the other thing, too. Like, maybe those holes in a roster don't shine during an NBA regular season when you're playing four games in 5 nights, when you have no practice time, when you're traveling all over the country. But, like, you look at this Bulls roster, and there's just quite a few spots that can be exploited in a seven-game series. Doug McDermott's played really well for the Bulls lately, and I think that, you know, since I wrote that post, I'm going to take credit for sparking Doug McDermott, because I was very critical of the front office's decision to trade 2 first-round draft picks for him. Now he's been pretty good, so I'm happy for Doug. I definitely think he can help the team offensively, but, you know, other teams just target him and Gasol so much in the pick-and-roll that... you know, it's just tough to watch, because it does feel like this window for the Bulls is closing. And yeah, I mean, that potential Kings trade I really liked, because I think Kufos is still pretty underrated. I don't know about you, but his stock seemed to be pretty high when he was backing up Gasol in Memphis a year ago. I still think that he can contribute a bit on the defensive end, and the Bulls could use a young defensive-minded center with Joakim Noah potentially exiting. There's not really another player like that on the roster. Bobby Portis is sort of the future there, but he's more of an offensive-minded, you know, 4-5 hybrid. And the opportunity to upgrade Tony Snell, who looks like a complete bust, Ben McLemore, who also hasn't been very impressive, but, you know, I think some of that might just be the Kings' stink getting on him. Maybe the Bulls could resurrect him a little bit. They're even doing that to a certain extent with Justin Holiday now, which was a pretty savvy trade deadline move by the Bulls, trading Kirk Heinrich for Justin Holiday in a second-round pick. So, yeah, I mean, it's more just about, you know, the opportunity. And you see it, the window closing, and it's sort of tough to come to grips with as a fan, because, you know, this era of Bulls basketball these last 7 years or so, the team's been really good, really fun to root for, and, you know, a team you wanted to feel invested in. Now it's closing, and you just wonder if the front office is going to be competent enough to get him back in that position.
Yeah, the window part of it is also really interesting to me, because it did look like, you know, that season when Rose won MVP, that they were going to be a team that for the next 4 or 5, however many years that the Heat were together, that the Bulls were going to be, you know, that 1A challenger every single year. They had a good series insofar as, you know, it was fun and interesting to watch. Obviously, the Heat won it fairly handily. I think it was 4-1, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, it was. Bulls won the first game and then lost the rest.
Right, but it wasn't like they didn't belong on the court with them. It was like, this is a younger team that's going to be back to challenge these guys in the future, and we'll see what happens. And then obviously you get so many injuries, obviously, to Rose and to Noah and even to Butler within certain seasons, and Dang in the playoffs 1 year. To see a window look like it's wide open for the foreseeable future, And I mean, I guess that's, you know, 4 or 5 years ago now, so it did stay open for a while. It just doesn't feel like it was ever open as wide as it was in that first year when it looked like they would be there forever.
Yeah, and the injuries definitely have a lot to do with it. Like, anytime you got literally the youngest MVP in league history just decimated by injuries, there's no denying the fact that just the franchise changed. When Rose tore his ACL, it changed when he tore his meniscus, you know, 2 years later in Portland after he sat out the entirety of the next season. He comes back, tears his meniscus 10 games into his comeback season, chooses to have the surgery that cost him the whole year. It's tough because, you know, I think that you probably recognize this too as a Knicks fan in New York. Like, the best teams are in the West. They've all been in the West for how long at this point? I mean, it might be 15 years, but if we're just looking, you know, at recent history, there's no denying that, you know, probably 5 of the 6 best teams have been in the West for the last 4 or 5 seasons.
Yeah, it's been the best West teams and then LeBron's team. It's been the West teams and then LeBron's team, and that's it.
Right, like, this is going to be the 6th year in a row, I believe, right? LeBron's going to go to the finals, and it's like, no, there's no realistic challenger to it. Why shouldn't that be the Bulls and the Knicks? You know what I mean? So,
yeah, I don't know. I feel you for sure. I do want to talk a little bit about, you know, the brand of, I think you called it, like, they're drowning in their own incompetence, which I thought was, first of all, a terrific turn of phrase. And second of all, sort of an accurate portrayal of not necessarily their failure, because again, they've been very good, but it just has, every year it seems like, okay, there's a move for the Bulls to make at the deadline that they can be the surefire Eastern Conference Finals team against LeBron. And every year people are like, oh, the Bulls should go get this, the Bulls should go get that, and they just never do anything at the deadline. If they do, it's something like this year when they were just like, we're going to trade Kirk Heinrich so we can save some money.
Dude, they have not made a trade to improve the team since they got John Salmons and Brad Miller the year before Thibodeau arrived. That was the last time they made a trade to improve the team. It's absurd.
First of all, John Salmons is maybe the best player out of the University of Miami to come into the NBA since, like, Rick Barry.
Wow, and also the best trade deadline guy. Every time you get him after the trade deadline, he turns into, like, a fringe all-star.
Oh, my God, it was unbelievable. It was, like, 3 or 4 years in a row where he got traded and then had an unbelievable stretch run.
You can count on him to just hit some totally bogus jumpers, to have the worst chin hair you've ever seen.
Oh, my God.
And to get buckets in crunch time.
And wear a good headband. Like, you can't put it past John Salmons to have a great headband. You know, better than LeBron's headband, certainly. Sure. Which is, like, you know, 3/4 of the way up his head at this point. You know, obviously, we've been talking a little bit about, you know, where the Bulls have been, how they got to where they are now. You know, at this point, I think, would you think it's safe to say, I mean, not necessarily safe to say, but do you think they're going to make the playoffs?
I do. You know, it's funny because I was so critical of the franchise, but I really do think they're probably going to make the playoffs, if only because they haven't been healthy the entire season. And I wrote something just before that mega hot take that we're talking about today, sort of also blaming the Bulls for their own injuries because, you know, they fired Tom Thibodeau because he wouldn't follow these minutes restrictions because he was pushing his best players too hard. And Jimmy Butler's still leading the league in minutes. Jimmy Butler's still playing injured. They've had all these injuries once again. And the thing is, like, they haven't played with their full complement of players the entire year. Mike Dunleavy was hurt out of training camp. Mike Dunleavy's really, really good. I'm not sure if people realize how much he contributes to the team if you're sort of outside the Bulls' bubble. Because even last year when Dunleavy got hurt, the Bulls were like 8-10 without him in the games he missed. They just need his shooting so desperately. And he's also, like, a very sneaky 6'10". How many diehard NBA fans even realize Mike Dunleavy's 6'10"? So,
I think it's because everybody, you know, when he came into the league, it was like, oh, Lil Dunn. So yeah. Everyone thinks he's small, like 6'7", like a Korver-sized type guy, but he's much taller.
Yeah, Dunleavy's a really, really good player. And then, so there's a couple other things. Like, they haven't played with Dunleavy and Jimmy and D-Rose all healthy the whole year. Etwan Moore has gotten super, super good. Like, Etwan Moore might be the fourth best player on the team. He's someone who's going to be a free agent after this year. I think the Bulls absolutely need to re-sign him. And Bulls Twitter has just been talking about how much money Etwan's going to get. The consensus is like $10 million a year.
What?
Etwan Moore. Yeah, dude.
$10 million? Yeah. I feel like that's like Kent Bazemore money.
Yeah. I mean, people are talking Bazemore could get $15 million, if I'm not mistaken. That's been the chatter.
Oh, God.
You know, at least it was a month or so ago. You know, everyone's going to have money, the new money flush.
But I guess you have to give everyone like a 15, 20% increase on what you think they're going to get because the cap is going up so much.
Exactly. Like, look at it like, what did Corey Joseph get? $7 million a year? Corey Joseph is a really good player, too. I wish the Bulls had Corey Joseph. But, you know, you could sort of see Etwan getting a similar contract, I think, to Corey Joseph, and then you give him the pay raise that's coming with this new money. Etwan, first of all, he just does not miss threes. He rips threes. He could play either backcourt spot, and he's the second-best perimeter defender on the team. The dude takes nothing off the table, and his skill set just complements all the other players really well. Both Derek and Jimmy have gone on record saying they want Etwan to play more, and he started playing more when they said that. The Bulls were running out Tony Snell, who's dribbling the ball off his goddamn foot half the time, instead of Etwan Moore the entire season.
The love-hate relationship of Bulls fans and Tony Snell over the last few years has been like incredible to watch from afar.
Yeah, Tony Snell, I mean, I don't want to call him trash here on your podcast. He's just had every opportunity and he's failed the season, so...
It's interesting because, you know, you look at the way the Bulls have drafted, and it was easy to see a sort of continuum where it was like, okay, they had Deng, they ran him into the ground. Then they got Butler, turned him into this great player, and he's playing a billion minutes, they're going to run him into the ground. Oh, and then they drafted Tony Snell at the same position. Eventually, he'll replace Jimmy Butler when he gets run into the ground. But that continuum has kind of stopped.
Yes, but if we are going to, you know, they have blown just some draft picks lately, it feels like. However, of course, the Bulls always have a way of sucking you back in. That's a classic Bulls thing to do, to play horribly and then give you one performance where you smoke the Cavs and they suck you back in as a fan. But... Bobby Portis looks really good. I think that Bobby Portis, potentially, one of the things I want to see is the Bulls' small ball look with Portis at the 5 and Mirotić at the 4. That would give them a 5-out look, which is something they never had under Tom Thibodeau. And most of the season, they've been playing Gasol and Gibson, who are two traditional big men. If you just look at the way Hoiberg's Iowa State teams played, he was constantly spraying the floor, playing at a super high pace. They never played two traditional big men because they didn't have one traditional big man on the roster. So if we are going to talk about the Bulls' drafting ability, out of fairness, I think for sure you got to give them credit for Bobby Portis because he looks really good. Very excited about him from a perspective of fandom. But, yeah, I mean, Snell, not a great pick. Marquise Teague, I can't really kill him when he was the last pick or second to last pick in the draft. And then, you know, McDermott's sort of his own thing. We'll see what happens with that. But they certainly gave a lot to get him. So, yeah, unfortunately, it does seem like Tony Snell will break the run of great Bulls wings who play 40 minutes a game. But what are you going to do? Can't win them all, I guess.
Yeah, I do love Bobby Portis. I said that, you know, before the draft. During the draft, I was like, when the Bucks came on the clock, I was like, if the Bucks take Bobby Portis, they're officially my new favorite team. Of course they didn't. They took Rashad Vaughn, and then, you know, Portis goes to the Bulls, and I was like, why does Bobby Portis have to be on the Bulls? Like, oh God. But, you know, the Bulls have drafted well over the last 8-9 years or so. You know, you look at their picks, it's since 2007 in the first round. It's Noah, Rose, James Johnson, and Taj Gibson. They took Kevin Serafin in the first round, but I think they traded him on draft day.
Yes.
To Washington. They took Jimmy Butler. They took Norris Cole, but that pick was also traded to Miami. Then Marcus Teague, Tony Snell. Then they traded two players who looked pretty good with Nurkic and Gary Harris for Doug McDermott, and then Bobby Portis. That's like an 80% hit rate of at least rotation-level players. That's really good, especially when you're drafting late in the first round for all but the first two of those picks.
No kidding, yeah. There's no doubt about it. Like, Taj Gibson and Jimmy Butler are two of my favorite athletes of all time. Those guys have just been incredible players and really fun to root for since the Bulls have selected them. You wonder if the Bulls' own ability in the draft has sort of made them gun-shy to, you know, ever make a trade at any point in the last decade.
Right, I remember even going all the way back to when KG was on the block for the first time, like even before he went to the Celtics, when it was still the baby Bulls. And they were like, we're not going to trade anything for Kevin Garnett. Like, we can't afford to give up any part of our future for anything that could help us.
Yeah, I mean, you can go, there's multiple examples of this in Bulls history. You can go through the Chicago Tribune archives and find an article that said the Bulls wouldn't part with Danielle Marshall to trade up for Dwayne Wade in that draft. Yeah, I mean, the Bulls have always sort of overvalued their own assets, right? And part of that is because they've always drafted really well, and I give them credit for that, no doubt. I do think that drafting well is the most important thing to building a consistently good team, and that's the reason why the Bulls have been, you know, sort of this pseudo-contender in the Eastern Conference for the last 7 or 8 years. They've always, you know, drafted well. Thibodeau was amazing at developing their own talent. You just look at, you know, where Butler went from, where Noah went from, even Rose. Like, I don't think anyone projected Rose to be the MVP ever at any point in his career, let alone his third season. So, you know, they have done that. They have drafted well. But as I wrote in that article, they had a really good college scout named Matt Lloyd, who's now in Orlando's front office. He's the guy who drafted Aaron Gordon. I think I've been on the Aaron Gordon bandwagon for a while. I think that, you know, if he was in a in sort of a Draymond Green role in Orlando where he's playing the five instead of Vucevic, you would really see his talent shine a little bit more. But
they broke that out like a week or so ago for 2 or 3 minutes, and it was like they injected coffee into my bones.
Yeah, dude. Matt Lloyd, I think, had a really good eye for talent. And then as soon as Matt Lloyd left, they drafted Marquise Teague. They drafted Tony Snell. They traded 2 first-round picks for Doug McDermott, who is about as athletic as me and you are. So it's tough to, like, still give them the benefit of the doubt. And then classic Bulls, they reel you back in with Bobby Portis. Bulls are back. Now you feel invested in them again. But, yeah, I don't know. Hopefully the ability to draft well continues. And, you know, you just hope that they can still evaluate talent the way that they've shown an ability to in the last 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, that is, you know, sort of another reason why the, you know, organizational failure thing, and I hate to keep harping on it, but it did take me aback because when you draft as consistently well as they have, that's not necessarily, you know, the only thing you need to be a good organization. You need to make good free agent signings, which I think they've made some very questionable free agent signings, and they've also let good players walk in free agency. So I would say, on the whole, they've not been very good at that particular aspect. And you need to win trades, and they don't really make very many trades. So it's hard.
They don't do trades.
It's hard to say that they won them, but they do have this one thing, you know, that for the most part they've been very good at. And that might be the most important, not necessarily the most important thing to building a sustainable winner, but it's right up there. And it's kind of incredible that they've been good at it for this long and haven't, like, supplemented that with, like, anything. I mean, they've tried to go star shopping, you know, 2 or 3 different summers. They tried, obviously, in the summer of 2010 to get LeBron. Rose didn't want to recruit or whatever the hell that was. They tried to get, I can't remember who it was a couple
Mello,
of years ago.
They
tried to get Mello a couple of years ago. Can't really remember if Rose was willing to recruit then either. Didn't really seem like it.
He didn't show up to the dinner.
Right. But then Mello was like watching him work out or something when he was at his meeting. I don't know. It was a very weird time.
Yeah.
And Mello apparently decided on the Bulls and then decided against them. But, you know, you would think a team that's been as good as they've been and has, you know, such a, I think they have a better reputation as an organization than certainly the piece painted them as, and certainly than fans like to think they have. Like, they're considered like one of the pillar organizations, I feel like, just because of how much success they've had, regardless of, you know, the way they actually operate.
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you're really, like, in the you know, the funnel of the Bulls. You can sort of see through their BS a little bit. And, you know, they've definitely been successful. Like, personally, as a fan, the last 7 or 8 years of Bulls basketball has been awesome because I can always talk myself into the Bulls having a chance. There's always a young player who they drafted and developed sort of coming into his own. There's always a completely impossible win over the Spurs or the Heat or the Cavs, you know, that reels you back in.
Hey, let's,
one thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I just want to say one thing I wanted to mention, though, with free agent signings. And this has been a trend for, like, 10 years. So, like, the Bulls draft well. They develop pretty well. And they overvalue their own assets in a sense that could be defendable. But here's the thing. Like, so many times they have signed a veteran who's worse than one of their incumbent players, one of their incumbent younger players, and given him their spot. It's happened 3 times. You can go back to the decision to sign Ben Wallace when they moved Tyson Chandler. When Tyson Chandler was much younger, he was much bigger, much more athletic. Ben Wallace obviously had a great career in Detroit, but, you know, I think a lot of Bulls fans, myself included, could sort of see that coming, where, like, Chandler definitely had the brighter future. And it just seemed like Wallace's best years were probably behind him at that point. The Bulls were paying for past production more than future production. They ditched Tyson Chandler. He goes on to have a really, really good career. They did it again with Carlos Boozer when the year before they had a rookie power forward starting by the name of Taj Gibson, who was more athletic, a much better defensive player. They signed Boozer, and, you know, Boozer... Bulls fans have a very negative view of Carlos Boozer. He was okay. I don't want to rip Carlos Boozer too much, but, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that Tom Thibodeau realized about 30 games into that season that Taj Gibson was going to close every single game and that Boozer wasn't going to be on the court in the fourth quarter. That was just sort of another move where, like, do you really have to give Boozer a max contract when Gibson does so many things better than him already?
Well, and they did it to Gibson again with Pau Gasol.
And then they did it again with Pau Gasol. Yeah, I was just going to get into that. When they brought over Nikola Mirotic, when they still had Gibson on the roster, who was in the prime of his career, you know, and they still needed help on the perimeter for so long. Thankfully, Jimmy blossomed into an all-star player, and then, you know, there's a domino effect of how that impacts the rest of the roster, but... Yeah, they've just done it a few times where, like, they're so close, and that's the thing as a fan. Like, you know that you don't get these opportunities every single year. I don't think the Bulls are going to be in this position, you know, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, where you can count on them to, you know, have this opportunity in the East where the rest of the conference blows, where there's only really one good player reigning over the entire conference. And they've just come so close, and they've just... missed on some decisions that you wish they could have back, and I think, you know, those free agent signings are a good example of that.
Yeah, I definitely agree, and you know, that's not to say that Boozer and Powell weren't perfectly fine players, because I think they were, but it's just it's a question of resource allocation at some point.
Yeah.
And that's actually, you know, I know you have to go soon, so I want to do, you know, one final question of, you know, what do you think the way forward is now? Because I think certainly this version of the team this year is not a contender. And if they bring it, if they bring all these guys back next year, I feel like that's crazy. They're just not, even at full health, they're just not good enough to contend with the teams at the top of the East. So what do you think the way forward is? I mean, I know they have a decent chunk of cap space. But that will depend on what they decide to do with Pau and with Noah, and maybe with Taj Gibson if they decide to trade him at some point. Like, to me, it's, like, very obvious you retool around Jimmy Butler. Like, you don't have to necessarily tank and get really bad, but everything needs to be centered around him.
Yeah, like, that's the other reason why... I think I was so frustrated for portion the last month is just because, like, they brought back the exact same roster as last year. That team got smoked by the Cavs without Kyrie and Love. So, like, why are you bringing back the same team, trading Tom, or axing Tom Thibodeau, the sixth winningest coach in NBA history, and thinking the coach was the problem? Like, clearly the roster's the problem. Front office is a little delusional, I think, in the sense that they believe they built this contender when really they're not a contender. But here's the thing. I think that, You know, a lot of people, myself included, even someone who's critical of the roster, can look at the roster and see sort of the rough outline of a good team on the roster. It's just sort of like all the pieces don't fit. I think that they could definitely benefit from a quick rebuild. As you mentioned, I think, you know, Jimmy Butler, for sure, a pillar moving forward. He's the guy you really want to build around. And then, to me, the most important player going forward is Nikola Mirotic, because he was second in Rookie of the Year voting last season. He was tremendous last year. He really was. He was awesome at getting to the foul line. He was ripping three-pointers. He just seemed like the perfect type of new-age power forward for this team. His ball skills were even pretty incredible, too, the way he can put it on the floor. He's really regressed in his second year, and now he's had the botched appendectomy. That's a Bulls special, too. Complications from a surgery. Only the Bulls.
When was the last time one of their guys, I mean, other than, I guess, this most recent Jimmy Butler injury, when was the last time they came back from their injury on time?
Yeah, it never happens. The Bulls always give optimistic timetables, rush guys back, and then get them hurt again if they're not, like, accidentally removing their colon or something in the surgery. So I do think the way forward, though, is to see that Portis Mirotić front court. Like, not only does that give them a dimension they've never had, it also sort of plays into the style shift that Hoiberg wants to initiate. Portis can hit three-pointers, no doubt about it. Mirotić needs to get back to drawing fouls. He needs to get back to being able to attack hard closeouts, being able to make his threes instead of just pump faking every time he gets the ball. So I think, you know, the first way forward is finding your front court of the future, because I don't think it involves Pau Gasol. I don't think it's going to involve Joakim Noah, even though I would be open to bringing him back. I think that, you know, you got to see if Mirotić and Portis can sink or swim defensively, because offensively they're going to give you quite a bit, I think. Defensively, you know, it might be optimistic for me to think that they could survive, but you've got to see, and you've got to try to develop their defensive instincts to see if they can do it. Then I think they just need wings. You know, Butler, Rose, Etuan Moore, if they're bringing him back, that's a solid foundation. I think that, you know, there's going to be a lot of people after young wings and free agency. Kemp Bazemore's a guy you already named. You know, maybe a guy like, I don't know, Evan Fournier, he's going to get a huge contract, though. Maybe Alan Crabb in Portland, he's probably also going to get a pretty big contract as a restricted free agent. But I think that, yeah, they need to put a little bit more of an emphasis on wings to improve the depth of the roster that way, because it just gives them more flexibility, too, in terms of the types of lineups they can play. And then if they can ever stop this gaping hole at backup point guard, Aaron Brooks, every time he comes in the game, it just seems like other teams are targeting him defensively so badly. They could desperately use a young point guard who could either supplant Rose when Rose's contract expires after next season, or play alongside him. And, you know, I don't know how NBA fans nationally perceive Rose, but Rose has been pretty damn good the last, I don't know, since Christmas, really. He's not a good three-point shooter, but one thing I'll credit Hoiberg for is his ability to get Rose to avoid taking those threes. He's been really good at attacking the basket. He's starting to finish inside a little bit more. So, I don't know, D-Rose might be part of the long-term plan, which is something that would have seemed crazy to say even, you know, 2 months ago, 3 months ago. So, I think the way forward is really to nail free agency, to lock in your front court of the future, just to give Hoiberg more lineup flexibility, because at this point, giving Hoiberg the same roster you gave Tom Thibodeau feels like trying to put, you know, what's the analogy I'm looking for here? A square peg in a round hole, kind of, in a sense. Like, it doesn't fit Hoiberg's ideals, which were the exact reason you hired him. You know, the roster just isn't shaped to the way he wants to play. So, yeah, to me, that's the thing. Get some more wings, get a young point guard in there, figure out your front court, and go from there.
I think that's a good place to end this right now. Do you have anything that you want to promote or let people know where they can find your work, find you on Twitter, things like that?
Yeah, I'm at SBNation.com, mostly at the college basketball page. March Madness is coming up. I've been writing a ton about draft prospects. I wrote something about Scalabissiere on Kentucky yesterday. And I've got a massive 2,500-word mock draft about to publish Friday.
Nice.
So if you're ready to, you know, start watching a little bit of college basketball as an NBA fan, ready to watch the tournament, maybe that could be like a primer for who to watch, you know, from a pro perspective in the tournament.
Very quickly on that front, do you have my man Sheldon McClellan in the mock draft?
I don't, but I do think he's really, really good. He's someone who I could for sure see, you know, sticking around the league for a while, because league needs 3-and-D guys, and he looks very good.
He is really good, man. He's so good. I love him so much. I want him to be on Miami forever. Ricky, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Cool, thank you.
And we're here now with Sean Hyken, who covers the Bulls for a Bleacher Report. Hardwood Paroxysm alumnus, much like myself. Sean, what's going on, man? How are you?
Good to be with you, Jared.
It's, obviously, we're talking about the Bulls. We just taped, actually, with Ricky O'Donnell about, you know, the Bulls front office and how this piece he wrote, I don't know if you read it on Bloggable a few weeks ago about the organizational failure. So I do want to talk about, you know, not just sort of, you know, where the organization stands in the grand scheme of things, but also, you know, how things have gone for them this year. And I know, you know, you're at all of their home games, you're at their practices. They wanted to sort of change the way they played this season, and that was a big part of the impetus behind firing Tom Thibodeau and going to Fred Hoiberg. I think at this point it's sort of safe to say that transition did not go very well.
Well, and you know, you kind of knew that that was what was going to happen because the organization just kind of felt that Tom Thibodeau, because they hated him so much on a personal level, and you know, that's its own discussion as to why that relationship fell apart, but they had their own personal feelings about Tom Thibodeau. And they were able to talk themselves into thinking that he was the only problem with the team. And if they would just bring in a new coach and keep the exact same roster. Because they literally, except for Bobby Portis, the roster is pretty much the exact same as last year in terms of the guys who are actually rotation players. So, if you know, they thought that if they just did that, just made the coaching change, that would fix everything. That would solve everything. And, you know, if you bring in a coach like Fred Hoiberg, whose whole philosophy is, you know, I want to run, I want to play up tempo, I want to, you know, have a lot of ball movement, and you're still building your offense around Pau Gasol as one of your big, you know, offensive building blocks. That's just not something that's going to work.
Yeah, at the start of the season, did he talk about, because I don't really remember, did he talk about, like, why he chose to keep Pau in the starting lineup as opposed to, say, Noah? Because, you know, I think that, you know, at least theoretically, Noah would have been a better fit. Is it just because, you know, Pau has sort of always bitched about coming off the bench?
You know, nobody's going to admit this, but I think it's, I've heard this a few different places, and I think that there was something that, you know, there was kind of a handshake agreement when Pau Gasol signed with the Bulls in 2014 that he was going to start. And, you know, if you remember his last year or two with the Lakers under Mike D'Antoni, he just, you know, there were times where D'Antoni tried to take him out of the starting lineup for, you know, Jordan Hill or somebody like that, and Pau did not really take to that very well. Now, the Bulls have a lot more talent than those Lakers teams did, so maybe Pau would have been able to say, okay, well, you know, they're taking me as they can put Mirotic in, or they can put Taj Gibson in, or somebody like that, not, you know, Jordan Hill, but... You know, I think there was just kind of this thought that you could move Joakim to the bench, and Joakim isn't going to make a problem out of it. Because, you know, Joakim Noah, you know, as much as he's been here this whole time for, like, the whole Rose Thibodeau era, and, you know, he's been such an important part for their team. He won Defensive Player of the Year a couple of years ago. He was an MVP candidate that same year. But he's not going to complain if you move him to the bench. He's not going to make it into a distraction, whereas I think there was a thought that Pau might.
Yeah, I mean, and it's tough because, you know, again, Pau, I think, is the one guy that very obviously does not fit with the kinds of, you know, at least judging by how they looked when he was coaching at Iowa State, sort of the way that Hoiberg theoretically wants his teams to play. And then, like you said, they made him sort of a foundation of what they're trying to do. It just doesn't make much sense. And I think that has been borne out in the fact that They have the 26th best offense in the league.
Well, I mean, as far as the fixation on Powell, and now don't get me wrong, Powell has been terrific in the 2 years that he's been here. He's, you know, he's been an all-star both years. He's put up really good numbers. But, you know, when the front office is talking about after they didn't trade him at the deadline, they had that deal on the table from Sacramento, and they didn't end up trading him, and then they went out and said afterwards they want to re-sign him, and they view him as part of their core going forward. I think part of that is that the Bulls have such a history, and this is going back to kind of the stuff you talked about with Ricky, where, you know, some of the places that the front office has not really done their job very well. Like, if you go back through their history, you know, with Carmelo Anthony, with the LeBron, Wade, Bosch guys in 2010, they just, you know, they have this history of not getting these big names, and Pau Gasol is the one guy that's a big name, you know, even though he was kind of past his prime when they signed him. He's a household name. He's a guy that they can go to fans and say, look, we got a guy. And I think they value that at this point with Powell more than they value, you know, how he actually fits with the team.
That's a really interesting point. I hadn't thought of it like that, because that's something that I also talked about with Ricky, was that they have, you know, gone superstar hunting in multiple off seasons and not come away with the guy they wanted. And, you know, Powell obviously passed his prime, but, you know, there was a time where he was, you know, a foundational superstar type guy. And like you said, he's been good. It's just not necessarily a conceptual fit or a timeline fit, you know, except in the fact that the Bulls think they are a real contender right now, when if you look at where they actually are in the league, given the way they've played this year, they're pretty much not.
No, they're not. I don't think there's any reasonable way you can spin it that they are. If you look at, I mean, on paper, this roster has a lot of talent, you know, with Rose and Butler and Gasol, and then, you know, McDermott has kind of come along in the last month or so. They have talent. It's just not the kind of talent that fits together at all. And it's just, you can't ever, I mean, I think that they might be able to win a playoff series if they get the right matchup. And the closest thing I have to the right matchup is Toronto, who they've kind of owned the last couple of years in the regular season. But you can't look at this team and say, I think this team can win three playoff series and get to the finals.
No, no. I mean, coming into the year, did you think they were going to be like a contender, pseudo-contender type of team? Or did you see something more like what's happened?
Happening. I think pseudo-contender is probably... I thought they were going to be kind of exactly what they were last year. They were going to win 50 games and then get eliminated in the second round. I didn't think they had the talent to beat Cleveland. I thought Cleveland was going to, you know, have a lot more together than they have this year. Whereas, you know, with Black... it seemed like last year they had their kind of issues, and then they made those trades, and then this is the year they were going to put it together. Now the Cavs are still kind of struggling, so there still is a little bit of an open door there for somebody in the East, probably Toronto, to sneak in there and maybe, you know, pull off an upset in the Eastern Conference playoffs. But at this point, I think it's pretty hard to say that team is going to be the Bulls.
No, yeah, I agree that it's hard to say that it's going to be the Bulls at this point, but I think before the year, they were probably the popular pick for the team that was going to play LeBron in the conference finals, which I think they've been for the last, like, 5 or 6 years at this point, too.
Well, because they've done it before, because they played, the Bulls played the Heat LeBron's first year in Miami. They played them in the second round the year that the Heat won their second title, the 2013. And they lost that series in 5 games. They gave them a pretty tough series, though. And then, and this was the year that they didn't have Derrick Rose in the playoffs, and they still gave him a pretty tough series. And then last year they played them in the second round, and they were basically, LeBron hits that game winner, and they were almost, the Bulls, in game four, LeBron hits that game winner, they were almost up 3-1.
Right, yeah, that was an incredible shot. I mean, just...
Like, yeah, it was.
What do you think this year, you know, because... The main thing I think that they were trying to change with the Hoiberg hiring was the way they played offensively. And, you know, the results of the change in terms of scoring efficiently haven't really worked. But do you think the stylistic changes have even worked? Like, do they play to you much differently on offense than they did under Tibbs?
Well, they do at times. A lot of times it's pretty much the same, but you know, there are stretches, and it's not for more than a game or two at a time before they go back to kind of iso ball. But there are some players that, you know, McDermott is a guy that really has thrived under Hoiberg in terms of, you know, they're actually drawing up plays for him. Mirotić at times has looked really good in that offense. But then, you know, they still play a lot of extended stretches with Pau Gasol and Jimmy Butler together, and that just doesn't work, and it doesn't really speak well to the kind of offense that Brett Hoiberg wants to run.
So, to you, I guess, you know, judging based on that, McDermott and Mirotić, like the front court shooters sort of hold the key to being able to play the way he wants to play, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, you talked to McDermott last year when he was in under Thibodeau. First of all, Thibodeau is not a guy who really loves playing rookies that much in the first place, and so McDermott never really got into the game that much. And then when he gets in, he would just kind of stand in the corner and wait for somebody to throw him the ball so he could shoot a three. Under Hoiberg, they're actually running stuff for him. They're running stuff for him to get him an open three, or they're, you know, having him come off cuts and try to score inside. He's actually getting to do a lot more stuff, and he's really thrived, at least in the last month or so.
Yeah, he's been really good. Or not really good, but he's been, you know, he looks like a solid rotation player or better over the last, like, three, 4 weeks.
He still can't guard anybody, but on offense, he definitely looks like he can contribute to a good team.
And, you know, there are guys throughout the league that can't guard anybody that can still get on the court because they provide value offensively.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think he provides enough value at this point. He's enough of a threat, and I think it's because, you know, he's not just going out there and just standing waiting for somebody to throw him the ball. He's not. He has other things in his arsenal besides just that, and I think last year Thibodeau, one of the things that he didn't really do was allow him to do other stuff besides just go out and shoot.
He's also, like, when you have a guy who, you know, Jimmy Butler does have passing skills, and he does move well without the ball, I think, for the most part. But, you know, his offensive skill set, I think the way he's best is when, you know, you give him the ball and he tries to break someone down. And when you have a player like that, you need a distractor elsewhere on the court. And I think that's something McDermott does well, you know, not just because he's a good shooter, but because he knows how to move in ways that will draw attention.
Yeah, absolutely, and you know, Mirotić to a lesser extent in the same way. And getting Dunleavy back, you know, Dunleavy is not a guy that really gets talked about a lot as a, you know, as a key player for the Bulls, but he just helps them so much just in terms of stability stuff. He's not going to make mistakes defensively. He knows where to be offensively, and that's another guy that you have to pay attention to because he can hit an open three also.
And he's, well, not going to be Tony Snell.
Well, see, that's the biggest thing about that one game where the Bulls had Jimmy Butler back against Houston, was that, you know, now you don't have to rely on a lot of those, you know, Tony Snell. I mean, Justin Holiday, who the Bulls traded for at the deadline, has already passed Tony Snell in the rotation. I think he's gotten a DNP in the last three games.
I loved that move for Justin Holiday. I wanted the Knicks to try to sign him this summer. I thought it was a great move when the Hawks signed him this summer, and I was very surprised, given, you know, the kind of players that they like, that they essentially gave up on him.
I didn't think the Bulls front office knew that you're actually allowed to trade for players during the season.
Yeah. Oh, Ricky said the same thing. That was funny. The defense, I think, also is something that needs to be talked about, because under Tibbs, they were top five in defense, 5 of 6 or 4 of 5, whatever it was. They were only not top five 1 year under Tibbs. They are now 10th in defensive efficiency this season and moving down. I think since the start of March, in I think it's 5 games, maybe 6 games, they are like 13th or 14th. What have you seen defensively from them? Because Tibbs could have gotten a top five defense out of, like, you, me, and 3 other guys on the street. Hoiberg obviously does not have that reputation, but it does seem like they still have the bones of something there where, you know, they can walk onto the court and almost no matter who's out there, play pretty good defense. You know, not necessarily championship level defense, but pretty good. And that's interesting to me because beyond Jimmy Butler and Taj Gibson, I'm not sure who their really good defenders are.
Yeah, it's really hard. I think Dudley coming back helps. He's not, you know, an elite, like, lockdown defender that can guard the other team's best player the way that Jimmy Butler is. But he's going to go out there, and he's not going to make mistakes. He at least knows where he has to be on the floor. But if you look at, you know, Justin Holiday has been pretty active on that end since he started playing in the rotation. But if you look at their other guys who play big minutes, Derrick Rose is not a great defender. Gasol is obviously an awful defender at this point. So is McDermott. Joakim Noah, you know, this is a place he had not been playing well at all offensively, but they were a lot better defensively when he was on the floor this season before he had the shoulder injury. So not having him has not really helped things.
Right. What have you thought of Rose's defense this year? You know, everybody talks about Rose. They're always like, is he back to MVP Rose attacking the basket, blah, blah, blah. They don't need him to be that guy, I don't think. And he's not ever going to be that guy. You know, he has played fairly well offensively over the last couple months. Obviously not anywhere near that. I think it's almost more important to them that he, not necessarily more important, but it's definitely very important for them that he can work well, you know, within team defense. And what have you thought of the job he's done there?
Well, I think he'll get up for the bigger matchups with point guards, like when they're playing somebody like Kyle Lowry. But then just on random nights, you'll see him just kind of get lit up by the opposing point guard, and it just doesn't really, you know, you can't really look at Rose and say he's, you know, he's part of an elite defense, but, you know, he's doing enough offensively that I think he can, you know, he can stay on the floor, and he's actually helps them.
Do you think the difference, because you always hear announcers on Bulls games, when they're talking about Rose offensively, they're always like, you know, he needs to attack more, and to me, the big thing isn't attacking more. It's actually making the fucking shots when he attacks. Like, he's always pretty much attacking the basket. Like, you know, maybe he settles for the occasional jumper too many. But I don't think you can ever really say that Rose is out there and he's not attacking at all. And, like, that's the reason he's not playing well. To me, it's, you know, missing his floaters and trying to finish over two guys instead of making a play. Do you think that it's more that he's attacking more or that he's doing better things with those attacks?
I think he's making a lot smarter plays in the last month or so, because you have to remember the beginning of the season, he basically could only see out of one eye. And he was wearing that
which
mask.
Was insane. Like, why was he on the court not able to see? Like, it's just absurd.
So here's the thing: if he can't win no matter what he does, because if he goes out and plays when he only has vision out of one eye, he looks terrible, and people go, "Oh, see, he's never going to be the same player again. He can never stay healthy." But if he sits out to get healthy, he's soft.
Right. I forgot that Bulls fans are like obsessed with, you know, him not playing games because he's hurt. Like, I mean, I get that it sucks that the dude is hurt all the time.
Last week or so, when he had a few games, he sat out with a hamstring thing.
I mean, he's on track to play, what, like 65, 70 games this year?
Yeah, he is. And I think if you ask most fans at the beginning of the season, they would take that. He played 51 games last year. And obviously he played, you know, a combined 10 for the last 2 years before that. So, you know, you would think people would be okay with that, but every time, like, I will tweet this every time the Bulls say that, you know, he's out for, you know, a little hamstring issue, I'll tweet that out, and I'll get a million replies like, oh, here we go again, another time, Derrick Rose just can't stay healthy, and it's like, okay, calm down, he's just missing one game because, you know, and here's the other thing, like, part of the reason that he had all the injuries the ACL, like, the original one, is because he was playing through everything before that. He would have ankle things, he would have hamstring things, that were just like little tiny things that by themselves wouldn't be something that somebody would miss a game for. And then he would miss, you know, he would play through all of those, and all that stuff just adds up, and then eventually I think that contributed to him having the injury problems that he ended up having. So, you know, going forward, if he feels like, you know, if he misses one game, then he'll be ready to go the next 10 games, as opposed to playing through an injury and then having another serious knee injury. Like, I don't know how fans can be against that, but I still get, you know, you still get the jokes, you still get the, here we go again, like, whenever he misses one game.
Well, yeah, that's the internet. Like,
right.
What are you going to do? What have you thought of the interplay between him and Butler on the court this year? You know, everybody talks about, you know, do they get along, do they not get along? I really don't care. You know, guys don't have to be friends. Like, do you know anyone that's friends with all of their coworkers? I mean, I don't.
Jamal Crawford.
What's that?
I think Jamal Crawford is friends with every single player in the NBA.
That might be true, Jamal. You watch Jamal before games, and he literally knows everyone. It's unbelievable. But, you know, I'm way more interested in can they fit together as players than do they like each other. I don't think, you know, unless they eventually split up and admit that they don't like each other, we're ever really even going to know whether or not they actually like each other. So to me, I'm way more interested in how they work together in a basketball sense. I think conceptually, you know, the player that you think Rose is or can be and the player that Butler is make a good bit of sense. But I don't necessarily think it's worked out in practice that way on the court.
Well, I think lately, I think since Rose has gotten back over the last month and a half to playing the way that, you know, people kind of thought he was going to play, they have actually looked pretty good together in terms of, like, you know, they feed off of each other, and, you know, you have to pay attention to both of them as a defender. But, you know, it hasn't been perfect by any means.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a situation where, you know, they're going your turn, my turn, and just watching each other work. But it does seem like it's not seamless, you know? You know, they've been outscored this season by just about 2 points per 100 possessions with the two of them on the floor together. Over the last month, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, it's been a good deal better than that. I'm trying to pull it up now, and of course my laptop is going way too slow. And this is good radio right here.
Oh, you know, riveting.
Me checking NBA.com. Yeah, over the last month, they're just about even. And the improvement has all come on offense. But over the last month, they've also only played like 3 or 4 games together.
Right, and, you know, and then we don't know how much longer Jimmy's going to be out with this current setback with the knee injury. I think they said yesterday that he doesn't have any long-term issues with the knee, but, you know, he might still be out another week, so it might be, you know, more time for them to not be able to build that chemistry.
Right, that was where I wanted to go next. Like, I don't understand why you send a dude to, you know, the scariest man in sports, Dr. James Andrews, if there's nothing wrong. Like, I don't understand. Like, you don't send someone to Dr. James Andrews for precautionary. Like, I feel like I've never heard of that being a precautionary thing.
Yeah, well, you've never heard of a lot of things with the Bulls medical staff.
Fair enough. So I guess they, is that what they said, just a week or so before he comes back?
They didn't say a timeline. They said there was no lingering issues with the knee, or there's no structural issues, and it was just a matter of, like, there was no more swelling. It was just a matter of when he can play next. And the release yesterday said that he will return to practice, or he'll return to workouts, and he'll return to play when appropriate. So they didn't actually give a timeline on it, but if they said there's nothing wrong with the knee, you know how Jimmy is. He really, he wants to be out there if he can be out there. I would say within the next week or so.
All right,
he'll be back out there.
Let's assume he does come back in that week or so.
Sure.
Right now, today, they're actually on the outside of the playoff field. They're a half game back of the Pistons. I mean, would you think that they're going to get in there? I mean, they're in sort of like a 4-team bunch. The Pacers are 34 and 30. The Pistons are 33 and 31. The Bulls are 32 and 31. The Wizards are sort of a couple games back behind them at 30 and 33. I feel like it's not a definite thing that they get in, even if Butler comes back in a week.
You know, I do think they get in. If they get Butler back, and once he comes back, he doesn't miss any more games, I think they have too much talent to not make the playoffs. I think they'll get in as the 8th seed. Now, I don't really see them winning any series. I think they'll be eliminated in the first round, but I do think they'll get back in.
That's really interesting to me to picture them in as the 8th seed, because if they come play the Cavs again and they're actually healthy and they get worked, which is exactly what would happen, at that point, like, who knows what would ever motivate the Bulls front office to actually make changes. But it would seem like that would be the kind of thing where if their actual team comes back and just can't hang, that they would finally decide, like, hey, we need to pivot to a new direction. Do you think that that's something they'd even consider, or would they just be like, oh, we didn't have Noah, he was out, so we're going to try to run it back with him back?
You know, they're not going to bring Noah back.
Really? You think that's for sure?
Even if they want to bring Noah back, Noah is not going to want to come back. The way that they handled him at the beginning of the season, with Hoiberg going and telling Zach Lowe that it was actually Noah's idea to come off the bench, and then Noah coming out and saying, wait, no, that wasn't actually my idea to come off the bench.
Yeah,
and
that was...
Right, it was not great. And then, Noah, like I said earlier, he was never going to make it into a distraction, but every time we talked to him this year, you could just tell that he was not happy about coming off the bench, which, I mean, I don't know why he would be, and he was actually playing pretty well when he did play. But, you know, with his free agency, I think he sees the writing on the wall about the kind of role that he is or isn't going to have under Hoiberg, and I don't think he's going to want to come back.
Yeah, I mean, it would make sense that he wouldn't want to come back, but I would imagine they would still be deluded enough to think, like, if we would have had him back this year, that just seems like the way the Bulls think. Like, they're always like, sort of like that old Celtics team, like, oh, we never lost a playoff series when we were fully healthy. I feel like the Bulls are very much in that mindset too, like, oh, if we had all our guys, we would have really been competing.
I think you're probably right about that, but at the same time, like, this is the one year where they're going to have the ability to make some serious changes with their roster. They're going to have, with Gasol coming off the books, Noah coming off the books, they are going to have about $20 million in cap space. And I don't know exactly who they're going to go after with that, but they have an opportunity to bring in some players that maybe are younger and more athletic and fit more with what Hoiberg wants to do than the guys they have now.
Yeah, so we know that obviously Butler is one of their foundational players. They've expressed an interest in continuing to have Pau Gasol for some reason as a foundational player.
I don't think they're going to end up re-signing him, by the way. I think they're going to try, but I don't think they're going to.
That's fair enough. I'm more interested in, you know, who you think of the guys on the team now that they would consider sort of foundational guys for the next iteration of the team, whatever that might be. Like, it seems like Butler is sort of the only definite. Portis, obviously, they just picked in the first round. He looks like a good player. McDermott, they picked in the first round last year. And, you know, as we talked about for a couple minutes, has looked better lately. Do they feel like those guys are foundational guys? Do they feel like Mirotić is a foundational guy? I guess, you know, where do they stand on the non-Butler guys on their roster that are, you know, still young with room to grow and could be part of sort of the next version of the Bulls as a contender?
I think you pretty much just nailed who they look at as the long-term guys with Portis, McDermott, and Mirotić. And the other guy I would throw out there is a guy that we really haven't talked about that much today. And that's a guy that is always kind of thrown around in every trade rumor the Bulls ever have. And that's Taj Gibson. And I know he's kind of older than some of their other core guys. He's almost 30, if he's not 30 already. But he has one more year, and I've said this for a while. He has one more year on his deal after this year, where he's going to be making like $8.5 or $9 million. I would not. I personally think it wouldn't be a bad idea for the Bulls to do with him what the Nuggets did last summer with Gallinari and Chandler, where they, you know, did the renegotiation and extension where they bumped the last year up on its deal up from $9 million to, I don't know, like 15 or something like that, and then give him an extension. That's a guy I think is worth keeping around. He's the only one of their bigs who can play with all of their other bigs. Like, he can play when Noah was healthy, he can play with Noah, he can play with Gasol, he can play with Mirage, he can play with Portis, he can play with all their guys. He's, you know, he's been willing to come off the bench for so long in his career, and now that he's in the starting lineup pretty much every night, he's been solid at that. Like, he's a guy that I think the Bulls should look at keeping around, even though he's a little bit older.
At a certain point, is it, when do you get to the point where you have too many bigs as, you know, part of the future core? Like, you know, you have, again, Portis, you have, excuse me, Mirotić, McDermott is a 3-4 type, Butler is a 3. I mean, where do you find minutes for everyone? And, you know, they want to keep Powell, and, like, who knows if they'll actually be able to do that. But, I mean, that was a problem for them coming into this year, having so many guys in the front court to play. And that was before they discovered that Portis could play right now. I mean, I like the idea in theory of, you know, you have a good player that you might be able to give an extension and keep around for another few years. But, you know, does that take away from the other guys there?
Well, it depends on who they bring back. If Noah and Gasol are both gone, then I don't think they should have that.
Well, yeah, then you almost have to keep him around.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and I think that's probably, like, you know, that with this coming year, there's going to be a lot of speculation about Gibson, whether they're going to, you know, try to move him his expiring contract or whether he's going to re-sign. If they were able to, yeah. It's like, they're going to have a lot of cash space, and it's not like they're going to sign Kevin Durant or something. They're not going to sign anybody who's going to be like a max-level player. They're going to probably, if they don't bring back Gasol or Noah, they're going to use their cap space on, like, smaller-level guys and still have a little bit left over. And one of the things to do with that would be to, you know, give Taj a little bit extra and get him to stick around for a few more years. Now, whether the Bulls front office knows that the renegotiation and extension is something that you're actually allowed to do, that's a different discussion. But, you know, I think it would make sense.
People always seem to remember that expiring contracts aren't actually valuable anymore until it comes time to be like, oh, he's got an expiring contract, they should try to trade him.
Right, yeah, expiring contracts are not as valuable as they were a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the trade market the last couple of years, they don't seem to have value really at all. I mean, if anything, you want guys, you know, if it's an actual good player, you want them locked up for multiple years. You don't want them on an expiring. And nobody needs to trade for an expiring to create cap space. Everybody has cap space up the wazoo.
Right. I mean, that's just kind of the weird dynamic of with the cap going up. Like, this past summer, you know, the Magic re-signed to Tobias Harris to basically a max deal off his rookie deal. And there were, you know, there were people saying, hey, you know, is he worth that? Like, was that an overpay for him? But then when the Pistons trade for him, they traded a couple of expirings for him. They come out looking really good because the cap is about to go up, and that the number that he's making, like $16 million per year, is going to look really reasonable under the new cap. They have him locked up for a few more years. So I think years and, like, amount of team control under a fixed price is actually something that is going to, you know, become more valuable, even because the cap is going up again next year.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. The last thing I want to touch on quickly before we let you go.
Sure.
Rose, his contract expires after next season. Independent of whether or not they decide to bring him back for next year or the year after, I think that he's not necessarily the perfect conceptual fit next to Butler as a point guard. What do you think that player looks like? Not necessarily a particular guy, although if you have a particular guy in mind, I would be interested in hearing that too. But what sort of skill sets do you think they should be looking for? You know, because they need a backup point guard. They have for like 3 or 4 years and haven't been able to really find an actual good one. Instead, they've just cycled through like, you know, Nate Robinson and Aaron Brooks 100 times. What do you think that the skill sets of the player that, that ideally would play next to Butler in the backcourt looks like?
Well, you need someone who can shoot. I think that's a big part of it, because Derrick Rose still has no outside shot. So that's one thing. You probably want someone who can at least hold his own a little bit more defensively. If there was any way that they could get him this summer, and I don't think there is, and first of all, they're not going to have the cap space, and I also don't know why he would go there. With, you know, somebody like Mike Conley would be perfect.
What about, like, George Hill? That's a...
Yeah, George Hill would work. I can see that.
I feel like that makes a ton of sense. And look, if all you want is a guy who can shoot, I have a Jose Calderon for you.
Yeah, I, you know, the I mean, the Bulls could look at that and be like, hey, he's a veteran. He's...
That would not surprise me if they were like, let's bring in Jose Calderon as our backup to Rose next year.
Because honestly, he's probably a downgrade over Aaron Brooks, which...
Oh, he is definitely is.
I ...saying mean, a lot, because Aaron Brooks has not been very good this year.
He could not guard...
You know who's been good, by the way, is Etuan Moore.
Yeah, Ricky brought that up, too. He's been very good.
He's going to get himself money this summer. I don't know about, like, a big contract, but, like, he's on a minimum deal right now. He'll at least become... I think he at least has a new cap, at least, like, a mid-level player, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I thought, you know, sort of $5-7 million a year. Ricky was like $10 million a year.
I don't know if he's going to get that much, but he's going to get a big raise, and I don't know if the Bulls are going to be able to keep him, but he's a guy that I don't think he's a starter long-term by any means, but as your third guard, he can knock down open threes, he can defend people, he can play both guard positions. As your third guard, he's exactly the kind of guy that a playoff team should want to have on their roster.
Yeah, I think he makes a good deal of sense if they could try to bring him back on an affordable deal. Of course, knowing the Bulls, they let guys like that walk all the time because they don't want to cough up the money. So, who the hell knows?
Yeah.
Anyway, Sean, thank you so much for coming on, man. Really appreciate it. Do you want to let everyone know where they can find your work, where they can find your Twitter and anything else?
Yeah, my Twitter is just my last name, @Hikin. That's HIGHKIN. I cover the Bulls for Bleacher Report. I cover the general NBA for NBC's Pro Basketball Talk.
Cool. Thanks a lot, man. We will catch up with you soon.
Yeah, for sure.